All right. Good afternoon or morning or evening, depending on when you're listening to this, really. It's time for another episode of Webcomics Weekly. And with us today, as always, is our enlightened panel of expert cartoonists. Let me introduce them for you. Over in California, via the magic technology, it's Dave Kellett, Sheldon Comics.
It's good for your body. It's good for your body.
Hailing from Philly, land of cheesesteaks, is Brad Geiger.
Why is he crying?
An ex-Californian transplanted here in the great state of Texas, my partner in crime, Christopher Straub.
Hey, what you did?
Nice.
And you all know me. It's Scott Kurtz. So we're actually recording this a little bit early this week, but you won't know that.
But it feels right.
But it feels good.
We like it.
Feels good.
And hey, listen, you guys just came off of a convention I didn't get to attend. And there's the phone.
Awesome.
You guys talk a little bit about it while I get this phone call.
Awesome.
Well, we were down in SPX, Small Press Expo, in Bethesda, Maryland. And it really is a great convention, especially for graphic novels that aren't necessarily the standard superhero graphic novel that you see at most comic conventions. A lot of people come to find new comics and something that they're unfamiliar with instead of seeing the people that draw the comics that they pick up every week. And so it was a really good time. What was you guys' impression, Dave and Chris?
I love the show. I have never been before. It's probably about 400, 500 creators and artists and writers in one large hotel banquet / convention center. And Maryland was a beautiful place, and the people were very nice. And like you, Brad, I found them to be sort of an educated, well-read, comics-loving crowd that really came there to meet and support artists and writers. And that didn't have the corporate feel that your bigger Comic-Cons like your San Diego Comic-Con or your New York Comic-Con have. Far less spandex. I didn't see a single outfit, I don't think. And by that, I mean the sort of, you know, a dress-up-like-somebody kind of outfit.
Mm-hmm.
Very little corporate presence. What actually made for a very conversational, very friendly, very approachable convention. And I really liked it.
The thing I was most interested in there was how any other con I go to, I can get to Marvel and DC and Image and all the other different publishers that are in comic book shops. And I'm not interested in looking at those tables at, say, San Diego or wherever. But at SPX, there were so many little creators with their wares that I've never heard of before, people that I don't even know if they had a website or not. And I really wanted to see every single person there. I was really interested to see all the new work being made.
So well, this cool. leads to a really interesting question, I think, for the podcast, and that is, from an artist's standpoint, which is your better convention appearance, the large convention or the small convention?
Ooh, boy, that is a good question.
Well, thank you.
Chris, why don't you go first on that one?
I think it depends on where you are, but for most of the people listening and for probably all of us, it's better to go smaller. Just because, and I can peg it down to one experience I had. We went to we did a con in Wizard World, Texas, in Dallas, back before I lived here, and we had the option of either sitting at the artist alley or paying the extra money and getting into the main floor where all the movies and the TV and the toys and all that was. And the web cartoonist who we knew in the artist alley said they had a pretty good con, and we had a really terrible con. Because we were just lost in the mess of big media in that room. And that was just a bad experience.
Yeah.
So I think it makes more sense to go a little smaller.
I've actually found that there's a happy medium, you know? Like the big cons, you can get really easily lost in them. But if you end up at a really small con that nobody shows up, you end up spending 3 days sitting around wondering why you didn't stay home and maybe work on some comics. So there's this really happy medium kind of in the middle place where I mean, you want to feel like your time's productive, don't you? Sure.
Yeah, I actually think that the best way to do it, going back to Brad's question of which way is better for me, small or large, I think the better way to go is to divvy up your convention year so that you do one or two big ones a year and maybe one or two small ones a year. Because you change your pitch as a creator to suit the size of the audience, and you get different levels of interaction. Like at SPX, I had great, granted they were still quick, but I had great conversations with readers, both new and old, that I never would have got at San Diego Comic-Con because there's just that sort of pressure of constant crowds rolling by. And so I think a small con benefits you in that way. But a large con, I mean, I just don't do as much volume as business at a small con as I can do at a large con, you know?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think your central point there that you want to have a little bit of both is probably right on the money. Although I think to be sure, in the earlier stages of one's webcomic, I think it's a little bit more important to hit the larger conventions just for the ability to throw out as wide of a net as possible and get your flyers out and get your message out to a large group of people. And then once you build up a little bit higher readership, then those smaller conventions really become important for that really intimate one-on-one with some people that have started reading your strip.
I think that's true, Brad.
And you know
what's
building off
important
of what
about
Scott was saying, you know, sometimes when you go to a smaller con, or maybe Chris was saying this, the artist alley, it's kind of overshooting the mark to say, oh, I need to get a booth at every con I go to. I would imagine there's a great many cons, and SPX would be one of them, where everything is in one room. And if if an attendee is going to go to that convention, they're going to see everything. So it doesn't benefit you to drop another $500, $600, $700 for a booth when an artist alley table at some of these cons is 10 feet away from that booth that you were going to pay for. You know what I mean?
Right. And just as good.
And just as good. And will have just as much traffic and just as many eyeballs looking at your stuff as if you had a booth. And so everything from a mid-sized con on down, you might want to consider, especially if you're a small guy, go on Artist Alley rather than feeling the need to go a booth.
I was going to say that the key there to what Brad was saying about casting a wide net at a bigger con is something that I wasn't very aware of was necessary when I first started, and that was you can't just go to the con and expect people to come up to you. You've got to have the flyers. You've got to actually cast a net and be active in getting people to stop by your booth.
Well, that's absolutely right. You've got to be a little bit of a salesman or a saleswoman when you get behind your booth. You've got to be active. And I think we spoke about this in an earlier podcast, and that is the importance of getting flyers out there. And usually there's a space at every convention where they've got a table of freebies, and it's great to take a pile of flyers and stuff and get them down there. But yeah, what Scott's saying is right on the money. You gotta, as I call it, get up on your hind legs and approach people a little bit. When they're walking by, catch their eye and give them a greeting. You don't have to slobber on them and jump into their arms, but it's just something that lets them know that you're there, and maybe stop them for a couple seconds and talk about your comic.
I know that's hard for a lot of people to do. It was hard for me to do at first.
How do you break down that barrier? Because you're right, Scott. It's not a natural thing for a lot of people. How do you deal with that?
Well, what I was doing at first was immediately going into a pitch, like, "Hey, you ever heard about PvP?" You know, and it just felt forced to me. Like, look, I can say that to this guy. I can ask him if he's read PvP, and I know the answer is no, and he knows that I know the answer is no. And so, you know, I mean, it's like, I just don't see how that's going to be effective. But what I do is I kind of open – what I've been doing is opening with something more conversational, like, hey, are you enjoying the con? Can I give you a free flyer, I guess, is the closest I can get to actually just opening with the product. But Usually there's something. There's something about them you can pick out, especially if they're wearing a costume. You can say, hey, a nice costume.
Yeah.
Or, you know, even if they're wearing a T-shirt, you can say, awesome T-shirt. That's really funny.
Even if you don't like the T-shirt that they're wearing. It's
I don't know why you have to bring that into it.
You can just lie.
I don't know why you have to bring that up.
But, that's where those flyers are worth their weight in gold, because you can, like we said in an earlier podcast, you can hand that flyer out and people are going to instinctively grab it. And then you've got them for a couple seconds to make some light conversation.
Right, right. And it's like we were talking, I think Brad, Chris and I were talking about this at SPX too, is that some people will do the automatic pause when you hand them the flyer. And then you can do the quick follow up of, you know, hey, are you familiar with Sheldon? Or hey, are you enjoying yourself at the con? Or hey, what kind of strip do you like to read? And then some people will take the strip or the flyer and keep on moving. And that's okay that they keep on moving, because you, at the very least, you got someone who is busy and looking for other things, one of your flyers. And there's a chance on the metro ride home, or when they get home and unpack all their different stuff, they might flip through it and it might fall in love there. So you did half the job just getting it into their hand.
Yeah. So what do you think, boys? You want to go to the mailbag?
Let's do it.
Mailbag.
I'm working on. I just worked on a brand new cold open. You ready for it?
Sure.
Okay.
Here, you ready, Chris? Ready?
Yeah. Okay.
Hi. How's it going?
Hey.
Hey, Beatles or Elvis? I'm an Elvis man myself.
Oh.
Anyway, want to hear about PvP?
All right. I don't even give a chance to answer.
The guy goes, "Well,
I'm working on it."
And you got, and then you've got your hand in his pocket already.
And then 5 minutes later, I'm like, "You watch, Chris. You watch what this yields us." And then 5 minutes later, people are coming by the booth. You got free Beatles stuff here? All right, mailbag. Who's first?
Somebody take us home.
I'll be first.
Go for it.
Okay. This is from. It's from. From Lisa, or Liza. Excuse me. I apologize. From Liza. And she asks, a webcomic is something I've wanted to do for a year, but here's my question. I've had a lot of trouble with consistency. One of the things that stopped me from doing a strip is just this. How do you guys learn consistency with your characters? Simplistic designs, copy and pasting, or just lots and lots of practice?
I think
consistency.
Won't the answer be overwhelmingly the lattermost, that it just takes a lot of practice?
Well, not for you, Chris. You're.
Yeah, and I've suffered for it. We
you
talked
think so?
About that. Yeah.
I don't know. What I did for a long time is I didn't worry about it, and I had a huge problem with it. So what I did was I developed a template, and template's actually a bad word. I used to call it a cheat sheet. But what I did is I sat down one day and I just drew a lineup of all my characters. And I drew them all in proportion with each other, so they're always, you know, so I know exactly how they line up and who's taller than who. And then whenever I draw my strip, I would have a light board handy, and I would have that little cheat sheet underneath it. And I was freehanding the characters, but I always had that little, you know, sketch underneath to remind me, don't make him any taller than this. Don't make his head any wider than this. And I think it took a while, because I think a lot of times I used it as a crutch, but I think I finally learned how to use it just to keep things consistent.
Mm-hmm. But without that, I mean, then you have a situation where I am, where I use the same sprites over and over again, and I'm doing a story now where I can update the sprites specifically. I'm doing a story next week where Vanderbeam wrecks his suit and he has to get a new one, and that's going to be my excuse to redraw everybody, because I don't draw them the same way I did 2 years ago.
I find it so interesting that you're devising a construct for this. I'm surprised you didn't just wake up today and decide, make a new sprite, then tomorrow they look different.
My readers are cranky that way. They go, what happened? What's going on? What'd you draw differently?
That
you know,
is true. If you're not using the template method, you do have a much more natural progression in your strips as your characters just naturally develop. Although the thing that you're giving up on that is that sometimes you will draw somebody and see that he's got a fat head when you look at it in the cold light of morning. You know,
yeah.
But you know what? I'm forgiving on that one. I think that especially when you're starting out, I think it's forgivable to have some of your proportions off every now and again, and because that's all part of the learning process, and it's something that I think you make those mistakes early as a investment in your cartooning in the future. You know what I mean? Knowing full well that you're going to get better and you're going to keep at it. And it's a very forgivable sin, I think.
Mm. Yeah. And I think just to echo that thought, for me, the path to that has definitely just been to draw over years and years and years. There's if you're a hand drawing cartoonist rather than maybe say a sprite drawing cartoonist, then really the only answer is to just keep at it and keep it consistent and daily in your drawing, or weekly as the case may be.
Yeah.
How do you feel about how much of it is design? Because a lot of my artwork, a lot of what is my characters is design as opposed to my artistic style or ability.
I think actually you made a much more consistent choice than I did when you were sort of settling on your characters. Were I to do it now, my grandfather character would be designed much different than what I've fallen into.
Really? And, how would you change him?
What's that?
How would you change him?
I just wouldn't. I wouldn't have him looking necessarily the way he looks now. Or I guess a better way to say it is, I have slowly evolved it consciously into a design that I'm comfortable with from a design that I was very uncomfortable with, just because he looks so lumpy and gross in the first strips. And yeah. Go ahead, Ren.
No, I was just going to chime in on that. But I think that's absolutely.
But yes, you're right. It was lumpy and gross.
Thank God you changed it.
What I was going to say is that's another one that time is going to forgive. I think if you don't have a very designerly character buildup, like Chris or I'm sorry, well, Chris and Scott both, their character designs is started out very designerly. And I think if you don't start from that, if you start with a very detailed character design that has all these lumps and bumps and stuff like that, I think over time you're going to see that you're just naturally shift towards that designerly way of drawing, because time has a way, drawing the same image over and over has a way of ironing out all those bumps. And
exactly.
All of your characters are going to get simpler over time and an erosion of the original character.
And they'll also become more iconic. And you can look at almost any major comic strip character over a period of 20 years or 15 years, and the same will be true. Like if you look at the original, say, 100 iterations of Opus the Penguin from Bloom County, and then look at any time in the last 10 years, his beak has become an iconic series of swooshes, whereas at first it was just sort of a semi-bent elliptical curve. And that beak is what became iconic, because he clearly over the years found that his brush or pen stroke needed that to make it a distinctive opus feel, you know, and you just sort of feel it over the years, the right way to draw it evolves, you know.
I don't want to play devil's advocate, but isn't it possible to then, clearly I am going to play devil's advocate. Isn't it possible that you could learn to draw a certain thing very early on the wrong way, and then have that evolve, but still be fundamentally incorrect, you know?
I don't think so. I don't think it's as simple as just the line eroding the way I kind of put it before. I think you perfected it, and I think if you started with an imperfect character design, you're going to find a way. I mean, you're doing this on a daily basis, hopefully, or at least three times a week or so. Over the months and over the years, you're going to find a way to make that right one way or the other. Or, you know, like you can be very creative and do what you yourself are doing, Chris, and find some kind of construct that you can wave a magic wand and correct it overnight. But I think the biggest thing to worry about when you're doing a character design is worrying that you're going to get it wrong. I mean, obviously, you want to try and do it as well as you can, but yeah, there is paralysis from analysis when it comes to that kind of thing. And I think you can rest assured that you're going to get it right over time.
Yeah, that's true. That's the best way to say it, Brad, is don't let it paralyze you into not doing anything if you're too worried about the design. The design will evolve as the days go on. Let me ask you guys a question, though. Do you guys find the character design over the years, does it tend to get more lines introduced into the character or less lines introduced into the character?
I think fewer.
I'm simplifying.
Yeah.
I'm right there with you.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing, and I was just curious to hear what your thoughts were, because I think the haiku-like power of a comic strip is actually, and the iconic quality of a character design actually improves with the fewer lines that you have in it. And one of the reasons why Charlie Brown, per se, is such an iconic character is that if you were to deconstruct his design, he's probably made up of only 15 lines in terms of his head, you know?
Mm-hmm. Man, if that...
Although I have been trying to add more illustrator... like qualities to my work, but it just seems to always fall outside of my own characters. Like they kind of exist in this. It's really, I have actually a funny story about this. A couple years ago, I was playing around with my characters and I didn't like the way some of them looked. I kind of became aware of some design flaws in them. And I filled up a sketchbook with pictures of Jade and I had kind of worked out some design issues and I was drawing her a lot like the way she's drawn now, but at the time she didn't look anything like that. My brother came by and saw the sketchbook and said, what is this? And I said, this is how I'm gonna draw Jade from now on. And he went, no, you can't do that. And I said, why not? It looks better. And he goes, no, you're right, it does look better, but you just can't. You can't just tomorrow she looks like this. It's not gonna work. You have to introduce all this over time. So you get one right now. What do you want to change now? You get one thing. You've changed her eyes, you've changed the way her ponytail falls. You've changed her jawline. You've changed the way you draw her shoulders. What do you want first? And I went, well, I want the ponytail. And he goes, okay, you can change the ponytail. And then I'll tell you when you can have something else. And that's how I introduced all these changes into Jade.
And your brother was Scott McCloud.
No. I just wanted to give a shout out to my brother there because he was very instrumental in that, very, very conscious of it.
Well, let me.
No, I think you probably had a good point. I mean, if I can make an admission, I don't know if you guys remember. This was back in the early '90s when Bill Amand or Amend or Almond, I always say it wrong, of Foxtrot made a radical change of all his. Not, I don't know, what's radical, but a pretty significant change of all his Foxtrot characters, pretty much overnight. And I still to this day think that his initial thrust of it or his earlier designs were better for that strip. But he did make them much more iconic and much cleaner line. But it was really drastic and really dramatic as a reader to take in that overnight change. So I think your brother had a good point, Scott.
Oh, and another cartoonist did that, Dave. The Sally Forth cartoonist hired a guy to help him with his art and let him change it up a bit, and it went nuts. Do you guys remember that?
I do, yeah.
And then he went back to drawing the heads.
Yeah, well, if I remember that story right, and correct me if I'm wrong, he brought the artist in because he wasn't comfortable with his art. It was very flat and static and
yeah, he didn't like. He'd think he was good enough.
Boring. And he brought this artist in. The artist really breathed life into it. His readers all told him that they hated it. And again, I might be getting this wrong, so correct me and forgive me if I am. But he had to go back and take a certain part of that and make it back. Bring it back to that static look that he had cultivated because that's what his readers were familiar with.
Yeah, no, you're right, Brad. The new artist drew everything but the heads, and then the old guy would go back in and draw the heads in.
Do you have time for just a quick tangent?
Yeah,
sure. Jack Kirby story that somebody that a friend of mine from work had told me. Jack Kirby when he came over from Marvel to DC, they brought him on to Superman, the title. And they this was a big deal. Jack Kirby's at DC. They allowed him to draw everything except for Superman's face. They brought in a DC artist for that because they were worried that he was some kind of like a sneak spy and that he was going to alter the face somehow to embarrass DC.
Are you serious?
Really?
I am told that that's from that Jack Kirby book that came out recently that talks about, you know, his history in comics. That's what I am told.
Wow. Huh.
He could draw everything but the face.
Done, though, given Superman, like, blonde ponytail? So terrible.
But that tells you how incredibly respected Kirby was. I mean, they were literally treated this guy like a sorcerer.
I can just see this thing where this guy in a dress shirt with suspenders and chomping a cigar comes into the editor's room and says, "Get in here now. What did I tell you about letting Jack Kirby draw the face of Superman? Why, what's the matter? It looks good. Really? Look under black light." And then when he flips the light on, Superman's face reads, "Marvel."
Yeah, it's like, "Buy X-Men number 135. You're like, "Wait a minute, Kirby!
Look at these sales charts."
Or he's got, you know, the shadow under the nose all the time that eventually morphs into the Hitler mustache.
And then, in the end, they can't really be mad at him. "What have you done?" "Well, I admit, I did put subliminal messages. Look at the sales numbers. People are moving from DC to Marvel in droves. Kirby, I can't be mad at you. That is damn impressive.
You're an American classic. I like your moxie. What?
I like your moxie.
I like your moxie." But then like the New York theatrical cartoonist who I can't remember, he starts introducing the word Nina into Superman's cape.
Hirschfeld,
yeah. All right, so let's move on to the next question, guys. What do you think?
Yeah,
exactly. All right, so I have a quick one we can answer. Email addresses. Okay. I do have a question, but it has really little to do with the strips at all. It's about email addresses. Do you use the same email address for your comic and personal life, or do you have two different ones? It's very presumptuous of me, but should my comic get popular, will I have a problem of having to micromanage my inbox?
Yes.
And in the worst way possible, not because of fans, but because of spam bots trawling your site for the email address.
Oh my God, do this. I gotta look it up. Maybe we can put it in the show notes. But there is a little bit of JavaScript, I think. And I'm sure now that we're all web 2.0, there's something better, PHP or something. But it lets you have a hot link to your email, but it is not crawlable or trawlable by the spam spam things. And use that.
I wonder if they have a CSS one.
And if you don't, just don't link to your email. Just spell it out. Or make it an image. But dear God, I get so much spam on my Kurtz at pvponline.com.
Really?
Oh my God, Dave, you have
no
idea.
I get no spam. I get maybe one spam that gets through a day.
What?
And the secret for me is that I have intentionally not moved my mail host over. I'm on a server that's hosted with Brightmail spam software, and that stuff is the bomb. That nothing gets through Brightmail.
Really?
I don't understand.
Brightmail has a series of algorithms that look for known spam patterns, and it's constantly updating based on the tens of thousands of people that use Brightmail. And so my mail server is tied into a Brightmail filter. And
how much does that cost?
Well, it's just standard. It's like $19 a month for hosting.
It depends on
where
your host
has it. My DaveKellett.com site, which is where my Dave at DaveKellett.com email is put through. And I think I do it over at I don't even remember. I keep all my personal email things, and then I use on my Apple, I have about 10,000 filters post-delivery that send my emails to different little boxes in terms of what to read, whether it's about Sheldon, whether it's about a store order for the Sheldon site, whether it's a personal email from Brad, or whether it's one of the questions for Webcomics Weekly. So it all divides itself up.
Personal emails from Brad go straight to
trash.
Trash.
That explains it.
And it's all of them have the subject line about that $20. $20. Hey,
is that why at SBX? Is that why, Brad? Now you know why at SBX when you walked up to Dave and said, "Hey, Dave, about that $20," he looked at you and made a finger motion and went click, 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 click.
Oh, hey, Brad.
This isn't working.
Hey, why are you going away?
This isn't working.
You just put a wastebasket on his head.
Spam.
So you guys filter. Do it for not of reasons for personal versus business emails. You do it for reasons of spam, then.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Well, I mean, filtering your mail is always a good idea to who's important and when.
Well, look, you should always, if you're going to have any kind of traffic, high traffic site with an email on it, That is your public email. That's the email. Also, I think I use that email to sign up for everything. Also, it's the email that people that don't like me use to sign me up for everything.
Yeah.
So I have a personal email. It's usually the email that goes with my my personal ISP. But now I have my own domain. But that's for business contacts and family. And then there's the main email. But I've been using my main email for more stuff now because of better spam filtering. If you're on the Mac, there's a great program called SpamSieve, and it is just fantastic. It is it's local side spam filtering, but it is the bomb.
Wow, that sounds neat.
But yes, definitely set yourself up an email account that you can't unspam an email account. Once it's been spaminated.
See, I have a bunch of fake emails on my site that just forward to my real one, and then if I don't like I ditch it.
I've got to wrangle my email up. It's my email's out of control right now. Seriously.
So, I looked it up. It's the one that I use is Brightmail, Bright Mail, all one word.
Yeah.
And it's now owned by Symantec. They bought it out recently, I guess. And they're on version 6.0, and it's a mail server based system.
This is an application that you put on your own server.
Yeah, you can put it on your own server, or depending on who your host is, they might have it pre-installed as a feature.
Mm. Wow. Chris, could I put that on my server?
You could.
Really?
Yeah, you could get your guys to put it on there.
Do you know? Oh,
I don't know how to do it.
Get like that, my guy Aaron, to put it on there.
Yeah, I mean, you need to telnet in and all that. I mean, I could do it. I just don't want to.
Well, that's what I'm at. I'm not. I wouldn't pay you.
Let's do it.
You guys are good business. No, I'll do it.
I don't want to though. Well, then we'll have it a weekend. Well, I don't know.
So that's what's the good use of having you here if you can't do any of this stuff?
I don't know. I honestly ask myself that constantly.
So the basic Brightmail license costs $25, $26 for 12 months.
Oh. And then that thing reports back to one of their servers, and then they all exchange what's spam and what's not information.
Exactly. And that's what works on a larger basis.
Boy, yeah. That might be worth it for me because I just have a huge problem.
Yeah, Scott, I literally have not thought about spam in years.
But what I'm saying to you, Dave, is it's not one of those things where you're getting it, but you don't deal with it because it's going into a filter and you trust the filter, or it's never even appearing in your inbox.
I get maybe 2 spams a day.
Must have. I must fix.
It's really good. And whatever it doesn't catch, I've set my Apple Mail preferences to catch what you know on my local side, what Brightmail gets through. So I don't even think about spam anymore.
Yeah.
Guys, I'm telling you, I'm living the dream.
Oh my gosh. You're like Dvorak. You get no spam.
So all right. So anyway, the suggestion though is to use separate email addresses.
That is still my advice.
I think just in general, it'll probably simplify your life to have one business, one personal.
Because then you know, whenever email comes into that is for your strip.
Yeah, I would love to be able to get Chris to stop emailing me. So this is going to be great if I ever do this.
And then the best part is that you would, once Brightmail your copy communicates with everybody else, nobody will receive my email.
You could train Brightmail to think Chris's mail is spam.
Nope. That guy, nope. That's bad.
I'm for it.
Meanwhile, Chris is over there sending out emails every morning thinking, nobody likes me at all. Nobody will respond to my emails.
Where's Chris? Where's Chris? In
is
jail.
Is this thing even working?
What happened to etiquette? God.
Hey, guys, where's
the creation of the new Star Slip book? Why didn't you write me? Why is my book coming?
All right, guys, we got time for one more from the mailbag.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know what?
Of course.
Before we do another question, I actually had a pro tip, and I haven't had one in a while.
Wow.
Awesome.
This is for people who draw by hand and who still ink and pencil by hand. One thing that rarely goes talked about is rulers that you use when you're drawing. And a ruler that I was introduced many years ago and has been a mainstay at my drawing desk ever since is called the see-through ruler. And it's spelled literally with a C, then dash, then T-H-R-U, ruler, and it's a completely clear plastic 16-inch ruler, and you want it 16-inch for all those times when you need to draw a little bit longer, and it's 16-inch by 2 inches wide, and the entire ruler is gridded out at right angles. So when you're creating your strip and creating pieces of furniture, say, or background art in the strip, that grid creates a natural perspective grid for you to work through, and also helps you create everything from as basic down to panels down to a table. And it's an absolutely wonderful ruler. It's beveled on the side so that your ink will not blot along the base of the ruler, as you might know happens with normal rulers. And a special little pro tip that I would give for this ruler is, overnight, using heavy books or in a confined space, give one edge of the ruler, maybe the last 4 inches of the ruler, a slight curve. And you will find it's amazingly easy to pick up and move around on your paper.
Oh, I see.
Slight curve to the ruler.
Nice pro tip.
No,
hey,
kidding.
I've actually got a kind of a ruler pro tip, too. I can't believe we're talking about rulers. But have you guys ever used those rulers that you pick up like at a drafting supply store?
No.
I have. I used to have one on my old drafting table that an architect gave to me. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, the ones that go, that are attached to the lines that are on your table?
I don't know. I know what you're talking about.
Those are draftsman rulers.
Yeah, but what I'm talking about, it has a little, the ruler has a couple of wheels attached to it, or one long cylinder that acts like a wheel. And therefore, you can draw parallel lines if you hold it in the middle. Draw your line and then pull it down. Those rollers will make sure that it doesn't move the other. It will move in a uniform fashion, so you can draw parallel lines.
That's amazing. Where is this? What's it called?
It's called a ruler. Let me see here. Let me see what I got. If there's a brand name, Staedtler makes the one that I had. Staedtler.
Wow.
And I picked this up at the art supply store. AC Moore, I think, has it. Pearl Arts and Crafts, I know for a fact, has it.
And what size is it, Brad?
I've got this one. This one here is 12 inches long. And they make them smaller, and I would actually, I don't know whether they make one, but I'd actually like one that's a little bit longer, because what I find is the longer they are, the harder it is to pull it out of true. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
But if I put my hand right in the middle of this thing, and just pull it with a gentle motion, it'll move in a uniform fashion, so I can draw real quick parallel lines. It's nothing that you'd want to draw really a careful thing with, but for like quick and easy parallel lines, this thing is beautiful.
How do you feel about T-squares? How do you guys feel about or a vernier calipers or a Goulombe ruler with a logarithmic the edge?
I don't use a T-square. I've got the thing that Scott was talking about, the straight edge that's attached to my drawing board.
Don't answer that,
that
question, Brad. That's a ridiculous question he made up.
Because Benchcraft makes a five-hole ruler.
It's not a real question.
Yeah. And the thing is, it's got a 45-degree angle. This thing's been machined, right? So you can get that right up against the edge of your desk. And depending on the size of the desk. Now, what I like to do is I use two rulers in concert, a carpenter's ruler and also a tape measure.
I can't believe you guys had to explain the gag to me.
I go through about 230 rulers a year.
All joking aside.
Although I do have one last pro tip on rulers, no less. Dave mentioned the bevel. If you don't have a bevel to your ruler and you find that you're smearing your ink, tape a couple of pennies to the bottom and raise it up off the off your paper that way. I heard that years ago, and it actually worked. And actually, it's a little bit better than the bevel, because that bevel only gives you so much, and you can kind of fine-tune it with a couple of cents there.
That's
you know?
Great. And I'll actually add an addendum to my addendum of pro tips. Instead of buying one see-through ruler, the one I mentioned earlier, buy two, take a Sharpie and write on one of them ink, and write on the other one pencil, put a clear piece of tape over that Sharpie ink, and then you have a permanent little sign letting you know which one to use for which, and you'll never get the sort of accidental ink dust during your penciling stage that you sometimes get if you use one ruler for everything.
I can't believe we've spent this much time talking about rulers. That's amazing.
Hey, this is important stuff.
Those are
guys' top hands.
Yeah, those are great things. Now, Chris, Pikas or Ciceros?
Oh, pikas. That's the most important. Because then you can go right into print.
I don't know if the ruler that I use, I don't know if you guys are familiar with it. It is the shift key. whenever you're drawing a line, just hold down shift.
No, Scott, you're like, and the ruler I use is the shift key. And we're like, Photoshop joke. And you're like, because the shift key is exactly 1.3 inches long. I pop it out of my keyboard and I put it on the paper.
You can make perfect rectangles with it.
It's actually the straightest key on the keyboard. True story.
True.
But you know what, Scott? Since you mentioned that, there might be some people that don't know that tip. So go ahead and tell them that Photoshop tip.
I have really got this this whole process down of doing backgrounds on really fast. I don't know if you've been reading the strip lately, but they've been back. They've been especially the last couple strips have been real background heavy, and I do it all by freehanding it and just holding down the shift key. That gives you a straight line, and you know, two or three parallel lines, you got yourself a door jamb, you know, and mm-hmm. then two or three horizontal lines, you got the top of the door jamb. And you just do them on different layers and move them around and then connect them, and you got yourself you've got yourself perfectly straight backgrounds, and it goes really fast.
And it actually works for Flash too.
So just all you got to do is with your pen tool, just hold down Shift and draw, and you will not be able to deviate. You can only draw
a straight line.
A straight line.
And you'll have yourself a good time.
And you'll appreciate it. I know Photoshop will. All right, guys. Time for one more question. You think?
Do you guys do you guys when you ink? Do you ever use that that little glove?
Oh, to move the page
used
around.
An inking glove? No.
I used to back in the day, but I used to take a little cotton one. Is that what you're asking about, Scott?
Yeah.
I used it way back in the day, but I found that it got too annoying. And the new inks that I use, which are both Micron or Faber-Castell pit pens or Japanese inks, there's not much smearing you can do after a couple of seconds anyway, so I find that it works out okay.
Huh. There you go.
All right, so let's go to the last question. Let's ask about collaborations. It says, hey, Webcomics Weeklyers, it's my dream to be a comic writer, emphasis on writer. Even my stick figures look like crud. I was wondering if you guys had any clue as to how to go about finding an artist or any other possible avenues you might know about. I'm not yet out of high school, so it's not like do or die time, but any tips would be appreciated. Your loyal fan, Chris.
Chris, did you write? You wrote
it. I am looking for artists, so. No. I always thought that was a really hard one, because if you're a writer, then you've got ideas, but you can't execute. But if you're an artist, then you're able to draw, but chances are you either have a really good idea you're already drawing, or you have a crappy idea that you're already drawing. So how do you convince an artist to collaborate?
I gotta tell you, man, I don't know how to answer this question either, because you know, I've known a couple people even recently that are writers that have needed to find artists, and we always come back to the same problem, which is eventually the artist decides, you know, why am I putting all this work into someone else's idea when I could just be doing my own idea?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
I mean, it seems like I mean I really don't know how to answer that question.
The only collaborations that I know of personally. All the guys or the girls in question were friends before they started the project.
Right.
Yeah. No, you're right. I mean, that's what Penny Arcade's that way.
Oh, yeah. I hadn't even thought about that one. But, yeah, that's true, too. I guess the only advice that I would have, and this is from someone who's never collaborated and doesn't particularly want to collaborate, is if you're in the high school age, get involved in your school paper. If you're college age, get involved with your school paper or magazine. And you will inevitably find illustrators, because they do exist, especially at the college level, who may want to take on a project. Because there are guys and girls out there that love the physical act of drawing, but don't and are very aware that they don't have storytelling abilities. So it definitely exists. It's just a matter of befriending them, becoming part of their world, and vice versa. So I would recommend getting involved in school projects.
And beyond that, I think you can get involved in like some of the different webcomic groups out there, you know, hit some of the forums for some of the groups. and become a little bit active. But I think you can find some things that way. And maybe for people who are a little, I don't know whether Craigslist is necessarily a great option for someone who's still in high school, but you know, down the line, you can also advertise there in a comics forum and so forth. But yeah, I agree with you, what you guys are saying about collaboration. Can I share with you guys my big pet peeve on collaborations?
Yes.
Sure. Oh yeah.
If you're going to be in a collaboration, do me a personal favor.
Here we go.
No, this one is
much
more gentle.
The anger is already coming out.
The curmudgeonliness. And maybe it's just me. When you're talking about your partner in a collaboration, please don't say my artist and my writer. That sounds so like that has such a degree of servitude to me. Well, yeah, I wrote the story and my artist did it. Like you own that artist or you own that writer. He or she is your partner. You know, you really got it. I think you can tell a lot about a relationship in the language you use. And I think if this is going to be a 50-50 collaboration, you've got to really be conscious of that language that you're using. Am I wrong about that?
No, I think you're right.
I like
that. No, and just for the folks at home, that's also true for Brad's marriage. So
I hate it when she calls me my husband. I mean, you know, like my cow.
No, I think you're...
Wouldn't it be funny if this is Brad actually reacting to his own marriage? Yeah. I've had to put up with this.
And please don't tell your artist to take the trash out all the time.
Right.
He'll take the trash out when he wants to take it out.
And if your writer is leaving his stuff around, I'm sure he's got a good reason. He's going to pick it up in time.
No, Brad, you're absolutely right. And I think that's a great... thing to end on. I'd like to thank my panelists. No, I'm just kidding. I've been very lucky. I've done one collaboration. It was that Truth, Justice, and the American Way, and Aaron and I really, you know, just gelled well as writers, but we were friends from before. And then I think Giuseppe is just an anomaly. That man is...
He's a genius.
He is a genius and an angel from heaven.
He's a great man.
And he can only work on my projects or projects I sanction. So don't get any ideas.
You know what? That's a good point, Scott. I think it sounds like you need a certain amount of maturity and self-confidence before you can really get involved in a true collaboration. Do you guys think that would be a true statement?
That's definitely true.
That's fair, because then you don't want to the artist is going to bring his flavor to what you're doing, and you can't try to wrangle that out of him.
Right. And also as a writer, if you're going to take the artist aside and say, you know what, I think you're drawing her, you know, drawing her hair too long, you've also got to accept that the artist can be just as able to come to you and say, I think you haven't truly worked out that plot all the way. You know, if there's going to be a one-way street, it's got to be a two-way street.
Right, right. You also have to be prepared to acknowledge that some of those calls are very subjective, and you have to trust that that artist's subjective call is just as valid as your subjective call, you know?
Right, right.
So it does require an artistic maturity that, I mean, it's every reason you ever heard of why a band breaks up, you know?
Yeah. Yes.
So it's all the same possibilities are there when two people collaborate. But, you know, it might make you a more interesting artist to have tried it. I don't know. Never having tried it myself, I can't say.
Yeah,
never having tried it, and never will be trying it. That's what it sounded like.
I did not say it with that tone. Yes, I did. No, I didn't.
No, I did. Yes.
Actually, collaborations is something that when we have a little bit more time, we could actually come back to, because there are a lot of there's a lot of discussion that can be done. For example, going into the relationship with a contract, so that both sides know what's expected of them and you know how this is going to play out. We could actually come back to that and spend a little time on it, because it's a valid concept.
Well, you might want to just go ahead and talk about it now, Brad. I mean, what I think that the baseline is, it is even just a written agreement signed between two people can at the very least provide a basis for your relationship, even in an extra legal sense. But it might even have some validity in a legal sense. But you're right. If you truly get to a point where you think this is a title that has a value, it's always better to have discussed it and agreed upon it before it grew to something of huge monetary worth than to try to do it after the fact.
Yes, that's and true. Please don't tell yourself, oh, well, this will never be anything. I don't need to worry about it now, because all it takes is one guy saying, we saw your webcomic and we want to make it a movie. And then all of a sudden, you and the artist are fighting over who invented it.
Wow, right. That is not the truth. Yeah, yeah. So start with a contract, guys. And it's a good idea to talk about everything down the line. And don't, like Scott says, don't be afraid of success. You know, plan for success.
Yeah, and know? I think there's also actually existing templates, maybe not in NOLO, N-O-L-O, Legal Press, but I think there is a book or two out there called something like Artist Contracts or Artist and Writers Contracts. You can look it up on Amazon. Go ahead.
The one that I always quote on this one is called The Graphic Artists Guild Pricing Handbook and Ethical Guidelines, or a Handbook of Pricing and Ethical Guidelines.
Jeez.
It's a great book. It's got sample contracts in there. It's got what you should charge if you're doing illustration for a 30,000 circulation newspaper versus a 1 million circulation magazine. It's a great book.
That
did you know
good.
That existed? I didn't know that existed, Chris.
No,
and that's a great tip. I'd forgotten about it.
And we get questions, or I've heard questions, like if somebody's doing some kind of contract art, like a drawing, how much do I sell that for? You know, they don't know what to charge for their work.
Does that title exist in a hypercube? What's that title again?
It is the Graphic Artists Guild.
And that's the author.
This is the whole title. The Graphic Artists Guild at gag.org is just what it sounds like. It's a union per se of graphic artists that have got together and discussed standard pricing. I just want to check. Yeah, Graphic Artists Guild. And you can get their book at the GAG website, GAG.org. And it's called The Graphic Artists Guild Handbook to Pricing and Ethical Guidelines. And it's, I'm telling you, I've used it in the past, and it's great. It lines this stuff right down. Between the different types of projects you might be doing, there's all sorts of things that are just specific to comics and comic books. And then it says, you know, if you're doing a black and white or a color, high circulation, low circulation, you know, stuff like that. And it helps you determine those fees, and it has sample contracts and a whole sidebar on how to read contracts, what kind of words to look for if you are given a contract, like what does work for hire mean and stuff like that. It's a great book.
That sounds fantastic.
Nice.
The GAG website is actually a great resource. As long as I'm on a roll here, they've got a whole I'm just checking before I say this. I can't do two things at once, so you're going to have to assume that it hasn't changed since the last time I looked. They've got all kinds of sample contracts that have already been out there. For example, I think there's an example of a King Feature Syndicate contract.
Huh.
And you can go through and read other contracts so you're familiar with them and you know what to look for.
Jeez, what a resource.
Brad, bringing it in.
What a day to be without my stingers.
No kidding. I don't have any stingers.
Can I delete my
earlier
pro tip about rulers?
Like Dave said, can you go back and make mine louder about rulers? It sounds more impressive.
Can you add in pixie dust sounds when I give my tips so that it doesn't sound lame compared to Brad?
Yeah, it's called now it says files not found. I'm not going to go any further because I think if I do, I'm going to totally ruin it. But yeah, check out that website. It's a great resource. I was just going to say they've got a section here called Contract Monitor. I hit the link and it says file not found. So they might be having trouble, but they do have
often seen though in bigger bookstores as well too.
Oh yeah, it's a great book.
In very large Barnes and Nobles or Borders and it's I don't know if it's on Amazon. I think it's only found online through the GAG thing. But yeah, you're right. Great, great book.
Oh, I learned something today.
Also, great tip about rulers. Great tip about rulers. We loved it.
You're special too, Dave.
I mean, you know, kind of with the rulers.
I'm sure your rulers are very nice, Dave.
All right, and here's my final pro tip. When you give a pro tip that ends up being kind of lame and someone else gives a career-changing pro tip, which might say someone just take it like a man. And that's my pro tip, is just try to be big about it and try not to dwell on it too long.
Take
and
it.
That's my stormed right in. I'm sorry, I stormed right in on your pro tip. That was very impolite.
No. And the second part of that pro tip is let them laugh right over you talking. That's the bigger thing to do. Let them just laugh right over you, because you're small and unimportant now, and that's what you need to know.
Well said. Perfect.
We're all just like, wow, God, Brad, that's fantastic.
And we're kind of nervous around
and
him
we
now.
We look over at Dave, and if you need to draw a straight line. And then Dave goes, with ink or pencil. That's right, Dave. That's right. Then
I suggested how to bend it. Yeah, that's good.
I think Dave just keeps popping in. Couple books, bend it on a corner.
Well, thank you guys for having me on for my last Webcomics Weekly appearance.
Easy to grab. Well, hell, that's a good point. Is any to stop? I'd like to thank my panelists.
Hey, can we let Brad do the outro again? I want it permanent.
Oh, yes. Please.
No, I totally screwed it up.
No, I am not kidding. I want you from now on to do the outro.
Go ahead, Brad.
All right. I think I can do this time. You've been listening to Webcomics Weekly with your hosts, Scott Kurtz, who does PvP at pvponline.com, Christopher Straub, who does Starslip Crisis at starslip.com, Danson David Kellett, who does Sheldon at sheldoncomics.com, and me, I'm Brad Geiger. I do Evil Incorporated at evil-comic.com.
Hey! Awesome.
In the shower for a week.
Brad, you got it 100% right. And fast. You are officially no longer doing outros.
You get a gold star, Brad. Gold star.
He goes, you guys have been listening to...
outro prison.
He goes, you guys have been listening to the Webcomics Weekly podcast. With me is Scott Kurtz. Oh, damn it. Hold on.
Oh, he just rewind. Recording.
All right, hold on.
You're listening to Webcomics Weekly.
Can I tell you, though, Brad's not kidding when he said that the last couple outros have been on his mind. When he and I were sharing a room at SPX, he was falling asleep going, huh? You've been listening to Webcomics Weekly. Brad Geiger.
Please.
I can do this.
I swear to God, I I've been practicing my own URL too.
Evilcomix.
It's important.
It is important. It's a little important. All right. Well, guys, thank you for making this a fantastic episode.
Thank you.
Thanks, Brad, guys. Thank you so much for that pro tip, Brad. My God.
My God, Brad. Brad's pro tip. Brad. Brad was better. I like Brad better.
Oh, I'm sorry.
All right.
Well, hey, guys, I got to scamper off to work. I'll talk to you guys later.
All right.
Bye, guys.
All right. Bye-bye.
See ya.
Bye now.